Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is funny. On the text page, back-to-back texts comparing Easterby to two different Game of Thrones characters.
Oh, I bet one is Littlefinger.
Easterby is Littlefinger. That's okay. From 7718.
Ooh, that's not a very flattering...
Easterby, Hand of the King is the other one. So not necessarily a character, but a title.
Hand of the King is a better one. Various Hands of the Kings at various levels of either, I guess, what's the damn word I'm looking for? Nobility? Yeah. Versus some are just kind of scoundrels.
Easterby was a conniver. Or not Easterby, I'm sorry. Littlefinger was a conniver. Yeah. No, Easterby, you're not a conniver if you're listening. Littlefinger was a conniver.
Was he for a brief while the Hand of the King?
Littlefinger was...
I thought he was a small council.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And if you don't watch Game of Thrones, you're really confused right now. By the way, I watched the battle between the living and the dead last night on HBO Go. I went back and watched some Game of Thrones. I haven't gone back and rewatched any of the last season.
Oh, that. The Battle of the
Battle of Winterfell.
You have to watch that 8 times so you can actually see things.
Yeah,
you
noticed that again.
Either make it extremely dark.
I was watching it on my laptop. Amy's got all these shows she records, and I don't watch any of them.
Yeah.
So Tuesday's like her day to catch up on all the shows. So we got all, you know, we like hanging out in the same room because we enjoy each other's company. I don't know if we're enjoying each other's company when I just throw my AirPods in and I'm watching Game of Thrones. Yeah. But maybe symbolically we're in the same room.
You like knowing where each other is.
I guess, yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah.
This is my daughter. My daughter's kind of like me, a little bit of a just, she's perfectly fine being. Sometimes
your own little world?
Well, sometimes I don't want to be around people.
Yeah.
I'd say a good portion of the day. Yeah. But I like being with the people I love. But she said it in a way that didn't sound as dismal as it is, which is like, I just want to find somebody that I can sit and read books with on the opposite side of the room all day.
That's not a bad person to look just for, honestly.
Read a different book on the other side of the room.
That's good at her young age. She has clarity on what she's looking for.
Yeah.
You know? Do you like going out and eating by yourself?
It's not my favorite thing in the world. I don't, I'm not comfortable in public for the most part.
Okay.
In general. It's probably something about me that people don't expect. Like, I really, really, really don't like, I get a little bit paranoid.
You have a very gregarious personality.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Like when I'm actually talking to a person, I'm fine, but I feel like everybody's staring at me in a room whenever I walk in. I've got a little bit of this.
Someone's got a pretty high impression of themselves.
Yeah. No, like in a judgmental way. I walk into a room and I feel like...
Thank you for clarifying.
I feel like everybody hates me when I walk into a place.
Well, that's not true.
I know it's not true consciously, but that's just the way my body reacts. Like everybody hates me,
right?
So Sean, I've been working on it for about 37 years. Okay, I'm making progress.
Seth, we're slowly gathering a list of Game of Thrones characters that Easterby could be. Someone just texted in the High Sparrow.
Ooh, oh yeah, that might be.
That
more
was
like
a religious element,
right?
Remember the High
Sometimes
Sparrow?
High Sparrow very much a hey, the ends justify the means feel to him.
But he brought a very faith based sort of ruling hands.
But he was genuinely devout, but because he was a true believer, he was also very severe and he felt justified in being the hatchet man, so to speak.
Some would say he was a zealot.
Right, yeah, he's a zealot. Yeah. Is Jackie, well look, zealotry can be great. You can accomplish great things with zealotry.
Yeah.
Sure. Do you break a few eggs along the way? Yeah. Might those eggs actually be actual human beings? Sure, but you can accomplish great things. Look at the magnificent feat that they pulled off in Jonestown, down in Central America. There, you think you could just clear all that jungle space and everything without a little bit of zealotry?
Probably not. No. Yeah. I'm gonna hold off on my Game of Thrones analogy until Easterby speaks publicly.
How close are we to Jonestown in with the Houston Texans? I don't think we're that close.
No, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure we're not.
All right.
So, speaking of the Texans, so we know that back in June, July timeframe last year, that the Texans had fired Brian Gain in early June, and then they spent the next couple weeks fishing around trying to find a new general manager, fishing around to the extent that they wound up getting accused of tampering by the New England Patriots because of their pursuit of Nick Caserio. And it begs the question, just yesterday, and again, I'll say yesterday's announcement by the Texans was just, to me, more validation of what we were kind of supposing already, as opposed to something that just hits us upside the head, like, holy crap, O'Brien is now the general manager? He's always been the general manager. Ever since Brian Gain left, he's been pretty much the general manager. I just started thinking of this question, Seth. Do we think that O'Brien even really wanted Nick Caserio here?
Because, and that's where the question becomes, all right, and did Bill O'Brien want Jack Easterby here? Is that, I would imagine he did, but did Bill O'Brien envision this role for Jack Easterby, or was it Jack Easterby gets into the building and starts filling Bill O'Brien's ideas with, you know, all right, sorry, kids, I'm going to make a Seinfeld reference here. But you remember the Seinfeld where Kramer starts talking to him? Kramer is this goofy character, kids, in Seinfeld, kind of a jackass, but he starts talking to this other character, Elaine, and filling her head with great ideas of what she could accomplish when she's in this role. She had become president of this company, and she was not qualified.
No.
But Kramer was filling her head with all these great thoughts and ideas, and pumping her full of confidence.
Yeah.
Till at the very end, all of a sudden, Kramer is full of crap, and it's a house of cards that's all been built up on her relatively fragile ego, and it comes crashing down.
Yeah.
So in this situation, is Jack Easterby the Kramer type that got to O'Brien and said, "Hey, you can do this. You don't need a GM. You don't need a director. You don't need a cap negotiator. You don't need any of these things. You can do it all." And Bill O'Brien's like, yeah, I can do it all. I can be the head coach, the GM, the offensive play caller. What else is he doing right now? I can do all of this. I don't need anybody else to help me.
I do wonder at what point O'Brien thought, man, I could be the general manager of this football team. Was it at some point when he realized that Brian Gain was not the, when Bill O'Brien realized, like, man, this Brian Gain thing's not working out like I thought it could?
Yeah.
Did he realize that maybe at the time when Rick Smith left, like, okay, we're going to bring in Brian Gain? I do wonder, like, how far out. At some point, Bill O'Brien had ambition to be the general manager of the team.
Yeah.
Maybe it happened the day that they got accused of tampering with Nick Caserio, and he realized that day, you know what, I could do this job. Or maybe it was 4 years ago when he was watching Rick Smith do it, saying, I could do this job better than this guy.
Yeah.
I wonder.
But Brian Gain and I are aligned, and I got to have a GM because I haven't won a Super Bowl yet or anything.
Yeah,
here we go. But then Easterby gets here, and it's like, no, Bill. You need to break the parameters and the mold. You can try to be like everybody else that ever was, or you could be your own man and forge ahead and be a revolutionary.
It's more just the thing that fascinates me than anything that really matters in terms of how the football team's going to do this year, because he is the general manager now. Like, it is what it is now, but it does make me wonder just, like, how sinister.
Yeah.
You know, like, ambitious was he when he got in the door? Did he just show up here as a guy who was drawing up his ball plays and coaching quarterbacks, and I'm just here on game day? At some point, it changed.
Right. Oh, well, yeah, and that's where I think it always happens. Look, with Andy Reid, it happened. When Andy Reid first got to Kansas City, he would talk about how it's nice not to be in charge of personnel. Like, it's just nice to not have that on your plate. But what happens is, invariably, at some point, a coach is going to start to wonder, well, gosh, I remember that I didn't like that player all that much, but then we drafted him, and look, he didn't work out. Or, oh, wow, I really liked that offensive lineman, but the GM didn't like him, mm-hmm. and now look at that guy doing well on another team. It's impossible to not start thinking that way. Now, some coaches do a better job of working through it and maybe just trying to have a productive relationship about it, but some guys just can't ever let it go. Does Bill O'Brien strike you as perhaps a guy who can't let things go?
Yes.
Yeah. Like that if, maybe you want to draft Garoppolo, and right from the very beginning, you could have had Garoppolo and foregone all the Osweiler stuff, all the Hoyer stuff, all of that, and had Garoppolo right from the very beginning. Bill O'Brien very much strikes me as a guy that would never forget that and couldn't move past it and could not stop thinking, wow, if only I were in charge.
Sure.
If only I had been the guy, you know, and you don't remember all the dumb stuff you thought too. Because anytime you're doing personnel, you're going to do some dumb things.
Yeah.
There's the greatest GMs on earth all have made dumb mistakes in the draft. Or at least in hindsight, they look stupid.
Yep. Get some good texts on these topics that we're talking about today. We've mixed in some Dusty Baker talk. He is not the manager of the Astros yet. We're going to talk to Richard Justice of MLB.com at the bottom of the hour, get his thoughts on Dusty Baker, where the Astros go from here.
One of our listeners pointed out, so this Bob Nightingale from USA Today that released the report, he tweeted out that the Astros had chosen their next manager. So it didn't report that they had hired him. Mm-hmm. And now everybody is pumping the brakes, and Dusty Baker certainly hasn't officially been hired. But Nightingale also wrote this article, which pretty much started out with an opinion. It was a weird, it was almost a column. He was like breaking news and writing a column about it at the same time.
It was bizarre.
So it's a strange situation. So I'm excited to talk to Richard Justice about this. Look, Justice has been plugged into MLB for, about 40, 50 years now.
Yeah.
I feel like Richard Justice wouldn't have written that article that way.
I would agree.
Yeah.
It's important to note, this is a text message, it's important to note that Bill O'Brien has not drafted yet.
Aha!
Did we get our first Bill O'Brien draft coming up?
Kind of.
Well,
we don't get a first round. Maybe we do. Maybe we get a trade up. You know?
Yeah. We'll
I mean, see. It would be a lot of.
They'd have to really like that player.
You're in the back half of the second round. You know.
I'll be honest with you. As many guys as they're going to be paying big salaries, as many more guys as are going to be making big salaries with this team, mm-hmm. Seth, this coming season. Fuller's going to be making $10 million on a fifth-year option. We assume Laremy Tunsil, Deshaun Watson are going to get deals. Yeah. Maybe. Zach Cunningham, guys like that, they need bodies. They need cheap bodies.
They need cheap bodies, and this is the other thing, and this is kind of like the nice little racket about being a general manager is it's hard to judge a general manager until you're a few years into it. Same way it goes with drafts. That's why you can't judge a general manager until a few years into it, because these guys, think about Dwayne Brown, think about Kareem Jackson, think about these players who were slow starters. Mm-hmm. After the first year, you're saying, wow, what a horrible draft. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, 3 years later, you're saying, oh, wow, those were good draft picks. So that's where it gets a little bit dicey when you start trying to figure out, all right, what exactly has Bill O'Brien done as a general manager? We know he made improvements through trades, but I don't want to say that those were bad moves. And I think they did improve the team, but you're buying on credit cards there. And sometimes starting a business with your credit card ends up working out. And sometimes it's a miserable failure. But we're kind of still in that 2 or 3 year process of figuring out whether those trades were appropriately aggressive or if, as one of my Twitter followers pointed out the other day, and I'm excited to talk to McClain about this because we had mentioned it a long time ago, but that Bum Phillips had been pretty aggressive in trading away first round picks when he was here, and it yielded them 2 AFC championship games.
Yep.
Something the Texans haven't achieved yet, obviously, but it also left them bereft of first round picks. They went 3 years without a first round pick. And after Bum was gone off to New Orleans, it was kind of ugly, you know? Mm-hmm. So is history repeating itself here? And by the way, and then remember, Bum went to New Orleans and then traded a first round pick for Earl.
Yeah.
Yeah, like after Earl was pretty beat up.
Basically been run over by a truck for about 4 years.
The difference, let's talk about the personality differences perhaps and how much maybe more accepting people were of Bum Phillips versus Bill O'Brien.
A little more folksy. Probably connects with the Texas people.
A little bit more folksy. What if O'Brien showed up trying to wear like a rancher's jacket and a cowboy hat next year on the sideline? That'll be his big PR move.
It can't hurt.
Yeah.
So DeAndre Hopkins yesterday was at a charity event. He was making a donation to the women's home here in town. Of course, DeAndre Hopkins' mother, a victim of domestic violence back in the day, she was there as well at the event. And Mark Berman, who there seemed to be like 10 of him floating around town, he was at the event, had a chance to catch up with DeAndre Hopkins, who acknowledged the injury he was dealing with in the AFC divisional round game against the Kansas City Chiefs, the rib injury. Here's what Hop had to say about that.
My teammates out there I saw was fighting with me. They was giving everything they had out there. It was no question that that I was going to stay in the locker room the second half. It was out the question, man. Especially playing a great team like that. I knew my team needed me, even if my presence was just out there. I was going to play for the guys out there with me. So it was tough, hard to breathe, but it's football. It's football. It's an injury. So it was nothing. It was football. I'd play with seven fingers if I had to, man. any injury is tough. It's a little bit more tougher when it's the hand that you have to catch with. But I miss football, man. I wouldn't have it any other way.
The last part, part was about a dislocated finger that he had in addition to the rib injury. Yeah,
right.
When he said he'd play with seven fingers.
I would point out that because of his freakishly long digits, seven fingers would be probably as much total finger length as still more than the average 10 fingers.
It'd be optimal for him, I would say.
I wonder how he chose seven. Like, oh, was he not tough enough to play with six fingers?
Yeah, and how many?
That
of
was
them,
my first.
How
thought.
Many of them are thumbs?
What's the right? Yeah,
the thumb is the real.
Oh boy!
Key.
Oh boy! Don't check the text line now. Now you're gonna get the whole. People think they're making some kind of a clever point when they're like, actually, there's eight fingers and two thumbs.
Oh, my God.
To the point where I had to go do research and say, like, no, the thumbs are actually considered a finger.
It counts as a finger. Just as a weird name.
Do you think when he actually thought of seven fingers, which fingers would you play with seven fingers so you'd be missing three? I feel like a pinky and then the pinky and the ring finger on the other hand would still be, that's where you're still most capable.
Yeah. In the power ranking of the fingers, thumb is number one, ring finger is number five, and then you can just juggle it in between.
What? How are you leaving index finger out? Pointer? You're going to leave pointer out?
Dude, okay,
where
try
is
operating.
Pointer? That's the first thing you
if
ask.
If you don't have a thumb, you're basically operating with a tennis racket.
Well, yeah,
on
if
your,
you don't have a
hand.
Thumb, you're like, you've put yourself into a different class of mammal. That's
right.
Tough. Yeah,
that's why it's at the top of the power rankings.
Yeah, but then you went right to ring finger. What the hell
no,
is
no,
your
no,
ring?
The ring finger's the bottom. I'm saying, No, hear me out. I said the thumb is number one, the ring finger's number five, and then I can take the other three in any sort of order that you would like in between.
I'll let you fill in
two, three, and four.
Index has got to be number two. The pinky really isn't good for much, just for maybe extra friction in certain situations.
But it's on the edge. You know what I mean? It's more important than the ring finger. Yeah.
I'm trying to think. My
the middle finger's important for obvious reasons.
I come from a farming family, so I'm thinking about my various relatives and the digits they're missing.
Yeah.
And which one is seems to be the most.
Which one would you want?
I think my Uncle Charlie doesn't
have. Which one is least annoying to go grocery shopping with?
Yeah. Well, I mean, these guys are still working, still doing real jobs. I'm going to have to poll them after the show. I think Kirk, my brother-in-law, actually is missing a thumb, which is tough because he's a golf course superintendent, actually. He lost it. Started off a farmer.
You're going to say
he's
a golfer?
Golf course superintendent.
Thumb. That's amazing.
But Charlie's missing, my Uncle Charlie's missing, I think, an index finger and part of his middle finger. That's got to be a tough one on his right hand.
How do those things, how does that happen? Do they get caught in heavy machinery?
Yeah, it's usually, and it's always when you're in a hurry. You're getting in a hurry. Kids. Just be very, whenever you find yourself in a hurry around heavy machinery, just slow down a little bit.
Keep
all your fingers.
Right. So as it turns out, DeAndre Hopkins had a broken rib that he played that second half with. He had a dislocated finger. And Seth, as we learned over the weekend, Will Fuller, who had sports hernia surgery over the weekend, had actually aggravated the groin injury that he came into the game with against Kansas City. So they would have been going into, this doesn't make me feel any better about losing that lead to the Chiefs, really, but they would have been going into the AFC title game with Will Fuller probably not playing, I would guess, if he aggravated the groin injury, and DeAndre Hopkins basically needing probably cortisone shots just to breathe.
What would have had to have happened for the Texans to maintain that lead? I think the biggest and most obvious thing you could say is, and I know Mike Florio would approve of this, is the only thing that could have really happened that would make me feel like the Texans had a shot in that game is if Mahomes had gotten injured.
Someone who took a cheap shot of Mahomes.
Look, not even a cheap shot. Look at what happened in the Texans versus the Chiefs. McKinney got a lick on Mahomes, and Mahomes was messed up after that.
Yeah.
And Mahomes' mobility, for a guy that runs the 40 in, it looks like about a 5.4 seconds, he is very mobile. And, you know, you saw in the championship game that run he had where it looked like he was jogging. Like, it didn't look like he was in a hurry at all or anything.
Yeah.
He's very good at running with the ball, and his mobility helps him a lot, and getting outside of the pocket helps out a lot. It's just that, so if they had done that, I'm sorry, Sean. I'm starting to think about my Super Bowl prediction and all the things that are making me nervous now.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time thinking about how the 49ers could lose that game because I've picked them to win.
Yeah.
And mobile quarterbacks have not been friends to the
49ers.
It's
the Kansas City Chiefs.
They're not the
Niners aren't going to hold them to 13 points. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're going to score points. The Niners' formula is probably a lot like it was in the NFC title game to run the football, man, and keep Patrick Mahomes off of the field. And let Kyle Shanahan's offense shine.
Yeah. So. Somebody's angering me now.
Why?
Somebody said, who knew that farming was a fast-paced lifestyle? Listen, you punk. You city-slicking bastard. Look, you know what happens on a farm? And this is what happens when you're like, when you're 12 years old, you have to work with the adults. And you learn that, like, oh, crap, the adults expect me to keep up with them. So you work your ass off. Mm. Like, and it's the hardest, most miserable work you've ever done in your entire life. And every second you spend away from the farm after you're an adult, you remind yourself, oh, my God, this is so much better than farm work. So, yeah, it's not like a fast-paced lifestyle, but when you work, you're working very hard and very fast.
Okay.
That's it. You come up to the station, I'm taking you out to Bale Hay this summer.
Are you?
You punk texter.
Okay, well, don't get mad at them. It's country music is the one that gives these impressions. Yeah. You got Tim McGraw sitting there talking about country boys and girls getting down on the farm.
Yeah.
When I think of farms, I just think of gigantic orgies out there because there's country boys and girls getting down. I don't think of heavy machinery and lost
none of
digits.
That. Yeah. I don't associate any of the
Sorry if you're on your way to school, kids.
Baling hay and shoveling grain and stuff like that. You try to get it done as fast as possible. Okay. So you're working very fast.
So
and
that
very
you
hard.
Can get down on the farm.
I would guarantee you the person that texted that in has never actually worked hard in his entire life or her entire life. Like not actual hard physical labor where like you're actually trying to finish the job
now
quickly.
I want to go Google their phone number to go see where they work. All right, the Astros put themselves in the market for a new manager and general manager when they fired A.J. Hinch and Jeff Luhnow a couple of weeks ago. At that time, I don't know if we talked to Richard at that time or after the punishments came out. It was about the same time, actually. They got fired in the same press conference. So it's been a couple weeks since we talked to Richard Justice of MLB.com. Reports yesterday that the Astros were set to hire Dusty Baker. They have not hired Dusty Baker yet, but I thought it would still be a good idea to talk to Richard Justice of MLB.com about where we sit with the Astros. Richie, it's great to have you on, as always. When you think of Dusty Baker, he's obviously someone you've covered for a long, long time. How good a fit do you think he is for this Astros team?
You know, it might be a really good fit. Until the contract's done, it's not done, because with veteran guys like that, a guy with almost 2,000 wins, he's going to want a significant compensation. I think Dusty said the two things I want in life now are a good team, a good roster, and a nice salary. And managerial salaries are going south. Dusty, I don't think, is going to come at a discount. But it does look like it'll get done. And when you're talking about a $2 billion business, this is a small investment. When I think of Dusty, I think there's a calmness to him. There's a credibility to him. He's one of those people that if you know him, you love him. And if he spends 5 minutes with you, you will think you just made his day by spending 5 minutes with him. That in more than ever before. Managing is a people business. Now, I do wonder, he's been in the game 50 years. There's nothing – he's not going to get rattled by any of this. There's nothing Dusty hasn't seen or done in the game. But I do wonder how he's going to deal with the youngsters in the front office who come down and want to help him with his lineup and with his late-game strategy. You know, for years in baseball, there was a wall between the manager's office in the front office. It was an idiotic thing, but that wall is gone. So Dusty is part of a generation that believes the manager should have some independence. But he had no problems in Washington. They shouldn't have fired. It was dumb for them to fire him. They fired him in a pick because they lost in the playoffs. We'll see. But there's going to be a cloud hanging over this team. I mean, it's a mushroom cloud. Every question is going to relate to cheating, even if it's not about cheating. The hostility on the road is going to be amazing. There's going to be hitters drilled, all that stuff. So you need a guy with credibility and a guy that can go, hey, look, you know, I used to joke, and this is true, I used to joke that we wouldn't sit by Hank Aaron in the dugout because some nut job might try to shoot him. In other words, Dusty's been through everything, and this too shall pass.
Well, and that's what I guess I wonder about Dusty Baker, because I'm watching clips yesterday that got me excited because they were showing different instances where Dusty Baker had definitely told his pitchers to pitch inside on somebody or beam them, and he was pretty open about it in the press. Is there almost – I know that he's got this – calm guiding hand and he's great with people and everything. I almost worry a little bit, like, man, if they're in this situation where they're dealing with other pitchers potentially being in guys and everything this year, could there possibly be too much fight in Dusty Baker for that situation?
He's so calm. I mean, he's so zen when you're around him. But I think a lot of those highlights you were watching probably were Cubs Cardinals. La Russa and Dusty disliked each other so intensely that there were times you wanted to say, why don't you boys just take it out in the parking lot and let the players play? I mean, it was amazing how intense. Those games were hard to watch. They were so intense because you thought somebody's going to get hurt. But, yeah, there is that school. I mean, like, I was close with Frank Robinson, people like that. They come from a generation where Nolan Ryan was part of that, where you enforce your hat, and whatever happened on the field, we'll take care of it. We don't need umpires. We don't need replay. We'll do it ourselves.
Richard Justice, MLB.com, joining us on Sports Radio 610. Richard, Dusty has not been hired yet, but let's just play this forward. And this would be a question for whoever gets hired to be the manager of the Astros, whether it were Dusty or somebody else. Where do you think Brent Strom fits into all this? And could you see whoever the next manager is maybe just delegating that part of it, the pitching element of it, right down to decision-making and things like that to Brent Strom?
I think so. I think Brent Strom's the most valuable member of the coaching staff. He's I don't only use the word genius, but he's pretty close to a genius. When Dallas Keuchel and Will Harris and Ryan Pressly and those guys all reflect on their careers and the money they've made and the success they've had, they go back to Brent Strom. He is wound tight. So, yeah, I do. You know, I don't know if this is your way of asking. Dusty has a history of going, of kind of giving his starters a heavy, heavy workload. But ultimately, those decisions late in games are the managers. You know, like AJ would rely on Brent Strom and his bench coach and all that. But ultimately, he had to manage the workload himself on that. So, you know, I think he'll be an important part of the coaching staff. But I also think that's another part of the game that has changed. It's not an 8-7, 8-9 inning game anymore. It's a 5-6-7 inning game.
Richard, did you happen to be at the Baseball Writers of America function where Justin Verlander received the award?
I wasn't. But what I wonder was, was that an unintentional? I think he didn't expect the reaction when he bragged about the Astros technology. I don't think he meant pitch usage, pitch sequencing, spin rate.
The high-speed cameras that they use for legitimate purposes.
Right, and what they meant was, you're a bunch of cheats. But you know what? That's a tip-off to what the season's going to be.
Well, that's what I was wondering about, because it was described as I saw in one report that it looked like he was making a joke, but then I saw in another report that he received derisive laughter. So I guess it's not so clear.
Yeah, and that's going to be the entire year. What looked like your advantage is now going to look like your way to skirt the rules. Hey, look, you know, man, Jim Crane has said, we're going to apologize individually and or collectively. You know, and Alex Bregman sort of had a smirk on his face at FanFest. Like, Alex, you smirk when you get away with it. You don't smirk when you embarrass your organization and stain your reputation. Like, what if they're two games under 500 on July 1 and Springer's hitting 220? I mean, the narrative is going to be, you guys couldn't do it playing by the rules, and the pressure is going to be cranked up and up and up. That's what you got to deal with. And the way you defeat it is you start 30-10 like the Patriots have done. You just keep winning and say, oh, yeah, we'll show you we can play by the rules.
You know, and you know, obviously it's hard to summarize exactly what most people are thinking in any group of people, but you obviously talk to a whole lot of people from all around baseball. When it comes to the buzzers, I think this is where I think Houstonians are perhaps most dug in compared to the rest of the world, where we acknowledge for the most part exactly what happened in 2017. We are suspicious of what other teams were doing, but when it comes to the buzzers, I think most people around here feel like, okay, you don't have any definitive proof, and there were a bunch of people that complied with an investigation, and Major League Baseball didn't think that all these people who were complying with an investigation were saying anything about buzzers or enough about buzzers. Does it feel to you like a lot of people outside the city of Houston believe 100% that the buzzers were being used?
Yeah, and Alex Bregman said, you know, I think he used the word ridiculous about the buzzer, but my answer to that would be, you open this door and don't say, oh, we would never do that, when you would do this, this, and this. this is what you're going to have to deal with. And the only way you can get past it is to go out and play and win. And it's going to take a long time. And 5 years from now, people are still going to be yelling at you. So I think the general consensus around the game is they would do anything to win. I will believe anything. Are other teams trying? As you know, Seth, in a competitive sport, there are always going to be people looking to cut every corner, and there's nothing wrong with that. But don't blame the technology. This was not a gray area. They knew what they were doing was wrong. And, you know, if it's just a question of a year from now, will we know they were doing more than we know now and all of that? We know they were doing something.
Richard Justice, MLB.com, joining us on the show. Richie, the owner of the Astros, Jim Crane, has promised that when the players get together at spring training, there will be an apology coming from the players. When you hear that in your mind, what do you envision that apology looking like? Is it a visual thing with the group standing there and somebody speaking for the group? Is it a statement? How do you, when you heard Jim Crane say that, what was the image that popped into your head?
That, what do you say? And how do you say it? Because you can't just do one group thing because, as you know, and they're going to be a topic of interest, especially because they share a complex with the Nationals. And so they're going to have reporters going to both clubhouses in one day or 2 days or whatever. And you're going to be in there every day. You have to deal every day. And guys like Alex Bregman and Jose Altuve make it a point of being accessible to the media. What do you say? How do you answer it? I want to hear what A.J. Hinch ultimately says. And Jeff Luhnow has said he didn't really know about it. I asked one of the managerial candidates, I said, what are you going to tell the players to say? He said, I'm going to tell them you don't have to quote chapter verse like I knew this pitch was coming from that guy, but you do have to say, I'm very sorry for what happened. I'm embarrassed for what has happened to our city and the organization, and I am responsible. Four guys have lost their jobs because of this, and I took part in it. And all I can do is go play and try to be a good citizen of the game now because I made a terrible mistake. That's all that, you know, if you try to justify it any other way, it's not going to give you a good look. And so far, you know, I go back to Alex. I mean, Altuve was pretty good. We're going to go back to the World Series. Okay. That's a good answer. Alex was like, I'm not going to talk about it. You are going to have to talk about
it. Richie, last one. We got about 30 seconds. Any feel for the direction they go with the general manager spot?
No. And I think Jim Crane trusts those young guys he has up there. I think he's leaning on them. The people who've interviewed said Pete Patilla, who's only 30 years old and has not really dealt that much in the big leagues, is the first among equals. He's brilliant. But do you have to bring in somebody else? I can't. You know, Peter Woodfork from MLB has been over the umpires. If you've been out of the game, away from club-level game for 2 years, it's been a sea change. I think it's a tough thing, and I think Jim is stressing over it, just like he keeps telling people in the managerial hour, I got to get this right. You know, this is something he didn't know he was going to enter into.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Richard Justice, MLB.com. You get him on Twitter, at Richard Justice. Richie, great insight as always. We'll talk again soon. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, guys.
All right, there it is. Richard Justice, great job getting us up to speed. So we'll see. Richard, pro Dusty Baker. And we'll talk about Dusty Baker here in headlines. Why don't we do that? Let's get started on headlines. John McClain jumps in with us at the top of the hour. Stick through headlines. We've got a giveaway for a meet and greet with Adrian Peterson at the TriStar Collector Show. They're going to be giving away here in the next few minutes. But let's start headlines. First headline today, Bill O'Brien, Jack Easterby, get titles. I think in terms of impact, I don't think it's a huge announcement. I do think in terms of the reaction of the fan base and maybe giving the Texans some clarity as to the direction of the organization, and I would say more importantly, we at least hear something in statement form, maybe not verbally, but in statement form from the owner, Cal McNair, how he feels about Bill O'Brien and Jack Easterby. O'Brien named the general manager along with his head coaching duties. Jack Easterby named the executive vice president of football operations. Seth, when you heard this announcement yesterday, what was your reaction?
My first reaction was, okay, we can be reasonably sure that Caserio's definitely not coming. I was still wondering if there was room for maneuvering or whatnot. And my second thought was, okay, so Bill O'Brien was definitely not telling the whole story when he was claiming that a committee was operating things
no.
and that he wasn't in charge, because the statement from Cal McNair very much right. said that this is how it's been operating with Bill O'Brien basically as the yeah. GM. Third thought was, wow, Jack Easterby, what an ascension from team chaplain with the Kansas City Chiefs several years ago to being vice president in charge of football operations. Man. And what a curious, strange trip it's been. And who the hell are you, by the way?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know what he does, and I don't know what his role is or how he got the qualifications that he does.
Are you with me on the we need to hear from Easterby thing? I feel like it's owed to the fans to hear from Jack Easterby. If he's a prominent enough member of the organization
yeah.
to have an executive vice president title where he's working alongside the person who's responsible for the product that people are paying for, then they at least deserve to get to know him a little bit.
I wonder how much Scott Pioli talked back in the Patriots state. But the problem is when you start talking about the Patriots, oh, yeah, that's right. They've got a whole bunch of world championships, and that's how they came by the structure that they have.
To be clear, I'm not talking about doing a weekly with Jack Easterby. Yeah. I'm just saying, dude, he hasn't met with the media a single time
yeah,
yet.
Yeah, there's a whole lot
about this
stuff.
Transformative personality that he
Everything
has.
Since Brian Gain got fired has been super weird.
Yeah.
And, like, attached to that, whatever connotation you want, whether it's good weird or bad weird, it's weird. So I don't think the Texans should feel puzzled by how much intrigue there is over this. It's a weird situation over there. Bill O'Brien himself said it was a unique situation during the season, even though apparently it was less weird than he was even hinting at.
Yep.
It's also weird.
It is weird. Second headline, Dusty Baker, as we just got done talking with Richard Justice, will possibly be the new Astros manager. There was a report yesterday from Bob Nightingale of USAtoday.com that he was set to become the next Astros manager. May have jumped the gun a little bit on that. He is not the manager of the Astros. We'll see if a deal gets worked out. Most of the stuff I'm hearing, Richard Justice, who we just had on, very pro Dusty Baker. The article that Bob Nightingale wrote felt like it was probably written with Dusty Baker sitting next to him. It was that effusive in the praise for Dusty Baker. To me, Seth, I've been somebody all along who said I don't feel like the manager vacancy is nearly as important as the general manager vacancy, because I just feel like this is such a talented team. It's going to win regardless of who's there. I just didn't want somebody who was going to upset the chemistry in the clubhouse. I like the things that I'm hearing about Dusty Baker in terms of his interaction with players and all of his previous
stops.
Right,
and I think the concerns about in-game decisions are valid, and especially when you look at what happened. Look, it's going to be a weird way to try to calm people's concerns about that. Look, AJ Hinch is a great manager, and he made what a lot of people think was an awful decision in Game 7. Mm-hmm. I'm personally more forgiving of that decision, but it's these things happen when it comes down to crunch time and you get to these basically coin toss decisions about what you should or should not do. And I think at this point what the Astros need more than anything else is a wise, I don't want to say old man. They need a wise, mature person to kind of guide them through what will likely include a whole lot of dips and valleys, as well as hopefully some mountains.
He's 70. He's at the age where he'll joke about it. He'll joke about his age at the press conference if he gets hired.
Yeah.
Guaranteed.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. You get that 7 handle, and it's you can start joking about your age. The New England Patriots, who are facing probably their most tumultuous offseason coming up here with Tom Brady hitting free agency possibly. This is one of those underrated losses, Seth, that maybe the average fan doesn't see, but we could see the effects on the field.
Tom Brady.
No.
Underrated, yeah.
No, not Brady. I'm getting to it. Dante Scarnecchia, the offensive line coach, has retired from the NFL. He is 71 years old right now, and he'll be gone. Mike Reese tweeting yesterday, I just spoke briefly with Dante Scarnecchia. Christian Fourier was actually the first one to report it on WEEI, former tight end for
the
Patriots.
Did he do it in his normal accent, or did he do a racial stereotype accent?
I don't know. He's okay. He's back on the radio, so he's probably minding his P's and Q's.
Okay, I gotcha.
For those who don't know, you can go look it up.
Well, you could do an Italian. Hey, Scarnecchia.
Hey, he's done. He's going to go eat some pizza.
Well, why you put your foot over there? You got to take a bucket step.
How impactful is the retirement of Dante Scarnecchia for the New England Patriots, who seem to have been able to just let guys leave in free agency and still put a good product out there?
One of the reasons you can call your offense a game plan offense is when you have a brilliant offensive line coach who can teach guys how to pay attention to detail in a shifting scheme whose responsibilities and rules change every single week. The Texans do not have Dante Scarnecchia, and that's not a shot at Mike Devlin. Dante Scarnecchia might be one of the best offensive line coaches of all time. He is one of the best offensive line coaches of all time. But he and Tom Brady, the reason you can have a New England Patriots offense is because of Tom Brady and Dante Scarnecchia, and obviously Bill Belichick.
Yep.
And that's the offense. It's not even a – there is no scheme. It's – yeah, those guys are awesome at what they do.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. So it'll be a big deal. Also, and when Scarnecchia was gone the 1 year and DeGuglielmo came in, it was a mess for the Patriots.
Right.
The offensive line really suffered.
Scarnecchia was a key reacquisition for them as they won a couple more Super Bowls.
Will they hire another weird-named offensive line coach?
Italian.
If you've got a Scarnecchia and a DeGuglielmo, you can't just go into a Smith or something.
No.
This would be a bad
Well, the
DeFilippo
character just got fired again.
Yeah, that's
from
not all that weird a name, though. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's Italian, I guess.
The guy, like, I want something that's hard to remember and pronounce.
Okay. 713-572-4610. Text in some hard names to pronounce for Seth. Antonio Brown, speaking of the Patriots, his last stop was in New England before they let him go. The AP reported Tuesday morning a Florida judge, Seth, has freed NFL free agent Antonio Brown from house arrest and will allow him to travel freely as he awaits trial on charges stemming from an incident in which he allegedly attacked the driver of a moving truck, a driver whose accent we broke down extensively on the show last Friday. Brown is no longer required to wear an ankle GPS monitor. Good for him. That's progress for Antonio Brown. He'll need to check in with the court personnel on a daily basis. His bail, $110,000, remains in place. Antonio Brown, the upshot of all this, quote, I'm planning to come back to the NFL. I think I've got a shot. Seth, you were of the opinion that Antonio Brown, after he was with the Patriots, would find his way back into the NFL last season.
Yeah.
Do you feel like he'll find his way onto a roster in 2020?
No, because I think, and I'm not saying this lightly at all, I think he's mentally ill.
Yes.
And he needs a lot of help, which is, lots of people that are mentally ill can get help and be fine. He seems to have a whole lot of issues yep. that are going to be hard to come back from, and I think of various other guys who may have had similar issues. That didn't. Well, you know
well,
what?
The court is mandating he get a mental health.
Okay. Richie Incognito. Richie Incognito had serious mental health issues.
Now he's a Pro Bowler.
And now he's back. So if he gets help and he actually is serious about getting that help, then yes, I think he would. But only because, and this might be the weirdest thing I've said in a decade, only in using Richie Incognito as his guide can he find his way back to the NFL.
Just picture Antonio Brown like doing a sales presentation on why he should be back in the league.
Richie
he hits the clicker and Richie Incognito's mug pops up on the screen.
At this point, I'm half expecting Richie Incognito to be the vice president in charge of football operations for an NFL franchise within 5 years. Why not?
Yeah, no kidding. At least he, actually played football. Continuing here, in Philadelphia, we've mentioned Allen Iverson a couple times this week in connection with the passing of Kobe Bryant. Allen Iverson, the number one pick in the 96 draft that Kobe was taken 13th in. Allen Iverson back in the news for different reasons. He had a backpack that was full of jewelry at a Center City hotel. $500,000 worth of jewelry, to be exact. It went missing on Monday morning, and now police have a 21-year-old man in custody being questioned by Philadelphia detectives in connection with the theft of the backpack. Police said the man turned himself into police on Tuesday, and he was being questioned as of yesterday. The backpack was taken around 10:30 a.m. from the lobby of the Sofitel Hotel at 17th and Sansom Streets in Philadelphia. Why do I put this in the rundown? To find out, Seth, what's the most expensive piece of jewelry you've ever owned, and what's the most expensive piece of jewelry, if any, that you've ever had stolen?
The most expensive, I don't want to put my business out there quite like that.
Okay, you don't have to say how much it was. Okay. Was it a watch or was it
watch.
It was a watch, okay.
Tag Hoyer from Zadok over
gotcha.
There.
Gotcha, okay.
Hey, look, I'm not spending money frivolously. They took care of me. I've been working with them for 5 years.
Just curious, man.
Most expensive piece of jewelry. The most money I ever had stolen from me was some kid stole money out of my wallet. I had my life savings when I was in eighth grade. For some reason, I had $200 in my wallet in school, like a moron, because I was going to go open a checking account.
You shook some kid down on the
school.
Playground?
Yeah.
Happened to be the day I was collecting on the playground, and I had $200.
I was supposed to open a checking account after school, and some kid, this kid named Kenny, they found out later, stole the money from me.
Wow.
Yeah, he wasn't too bright.
Mm, have you ever gone back now that you're a large person and beaten up Kenny for taking the
$200? No, I felt bad. Kenny was from a rough... it was one of those things where, he had a rough childhood.
Yeah, I got you.
I didn't feel bad for him.
I went a little deeper with that than I intended to. I had a Breitling watch stolen from me one time that was in a backpack in my car. The first day I moved back to Houston in 2007, my car got broken into at the old Buffalo Grill over there. It used to be on Buffalo Speedway. Now it's... a little further down on Bissonnette. Yeah. Car got broken into. They took my backpack. I had a Breitling watch.
Why'd you leave your backpack? Why'd you leave it in there?
It was my first day back, and I just packed things in my backpack. I landed and was in the car, and I just left my backpack in the car. I was going in to meet somebody for breakfast.
Yeah.
And I forgot I left my watch in my backpack.
Don't ever leave anything anywhere, okay?
I don't since then.
You hear me, Ed Reed?
Yeah.
You might as well, like, relative to your income, you might as well have been Ed Reed. Ed Reed leaving $50,000 in a sack is the same as you and whatever you were making at that time.
That's right.
Leaving a watch in there.
I was making zero at the time. I was in between jobs. Even worse. I had not officially started with Gow Media yet.
It's like Chris Rock talking about the difference. Like, look, if you have... whatever his bit was where he said, look, if you have $10 million and you lose $5 million in a divorce, you're still doing all right.
Yeah.
If you have $20,000 and you lose $10,000 in a divorce, it's a different situation.
You're buying a tent.
It's a whole, yeah.
last story, sad story. Been a lot of sad stories this week. Hall of Fame defensive end Chris Dolman dying at the age of 58 with cancer. Quote from David Baker, the Hall of Fame president and CEO, the entire Pro Football Hall of Fame family mourns the passing of Chris Dolman after a prolonged and courageous battle against cancer. I had the honor of getting to know him not only as a great football player, but an outstanding human being. Dolman was a really fearsome pass rusher off of the edge. I always remember Dolman had small shoulder pads, too. He was one of the first in the family of small shoulder pad wearers. Back in the day.
That's right, he was. Bruce Smith started the whole trend. Bruce Smith was the first guy, in my memory, to wear small pads because it was harder to hold. And I swear, I feel like that's part of the trend towards... I think players would stay a lot healthier if they would go the old Curtis Martin route, which is wear a suit of armor, basically.
Yeah.
Problem is, once you go that road of wearing smaller pads, you realize just, frankly, how much better you look. You look better. I look at some of these pictures of the guys in the 70s. In 80s, let's talk about the 80s. The 80s, a large portion of those players in the early 80s were roided to the gills.
Yeah.
These guys, these offensive linemen were like 270, but with 5% body fat and veiny arms and everything. But you look at them in pads and you think like, oh, these guys aren't that big.
Right.
Where nowadays, the guys aren't very, very many, many fewer players on steroids, and a lot fatter than we used to be back in the day.
Right.
But they look a lot better and more imposing in pads because they've got their arms showing and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So you try to convince people to wear bigger pads, you're basically saying like, oh, go look less like a man.
Are you mad you didn't wear smaller shoulder pads during your playing days?
I wore relatively small.
You didn't?
I wasn't. Yeah, they weren't.
You weren't.
I was in that era already where the pads had come down. Yeah. I wore a neck roll my first few years.
A sign of a try-hard guy right there with the old neck roll.
It's a sign of a guy with a severe spine condition.
Okay, well, that's so too. Now I feel like a jackass. Okay, thanks.
I would go large stretches of time without being able to lift my arms above my shoulders.
So. That was 1 inch away from paralysis on every play, and I'm making fun of the guy.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.